This is the 2014 Pacific Northwest School of the Prophets. Brother Jim Cowie is our study leader on the theme, The Kingdom of God versus the Kingdom of Men. Yahweh will destroy Nimrod. This is session 11, entitled Michael and the Great Dragon. Brother Jim.
Well, brethren, we are going to now go into the apocalypse, having laid the foundations in the last 10 or so studies, as we said it earlier. We're going to have a look at the apocalypse in the next two or three sessions. Now, Revelation 12 is going to be the basis of our consideration of Michael and the Great Red Dragon. I'm sure that most of you are familiar, having had to deal probably with people who have a different view of this chapter outside of the truth normally, and you've had to deal with that, so you'll have some inkling of what's in this chapter. And we can't obviously do it word by word, verse by verse. We're just going to have a look at the main issues that arise out of Revelation 12 for our particular study on Nimrod and his successors and the way that Yahweh will ultimately destroy him. So let's just take you back initially to where we were last evening. And you'll remember how we talked about the mystery of iniquity being at work way back here in AD 32. And we had a look at the two women of Zechariah 5, and we saw that two cities were involved in that mystery of iniquity at work in the ecclesia way back in AD 32, just a year or two after Christ ascended to heaven. It was there in Jerusalem, in Ananias and Sapphira, and it was there in Samaria, the two women of Zechariah 5. And ultimately, of course, through the gestation period of 280 years, the same length as a normal human gestation, the man of sin, Constantine, came onto the scene in AD 312. So essentially, that's what Revelation 12 is all about. And we're going to be considering some of the data that comes from that chapter in respect to Constantine and his warfare against those who stood in his way. So what we have in Revelation 12 verse 1 is a woman. Verse 1 says, "And there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars." And she'd been playing around, because in verse 2 we are told, "She being with child cried, travailing in birth, and pained to be delivered." So what's this about? Well, here's the development of the woman. When Christ sent forth his apostles, as Paul tells us in Corinthians, the acquisition of a bride or potential bride for him is referred to in the language of a chaste virgin. "I've espoused you," wrote Paul, "unto Christ as a chaste virgin." Well, that changed as time went on. Over this period of 280 years, which is where we get up to in Revelation 12 here, with this woman with the moon under her feet, the sun involved, that changed. So the chaste virgin became an apostate church in time, and, of course, let's just go back one step, and became this symbology. So here we have in Revelation 12 verse 1 a wonder. Not a wonder so much in something it's, you know, exciting, but more a sign or a token. A sign or a token for those who understood Bible prophecy that they knew where they were in the scheme of things. And that little remnant, represented of course by Jotham in the story of Judges chapter 9, that little remnant would be able to read where they were in the scheme of things as they were fighting against this apostate system and later on fleeing into the wilderness. Heaven, of course, in the apocalypse is always a symbol for political power or government. And here it refers to the Roman Empire. This woman was to acquire a place in the Roman government of the time. And we're going to see how that happened. And as you also know, a woman in the scripture is a symbol for an ecclesiastical system. We just quoted a little while ago the words of the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians 11 verse 2, that he would present the ecclesia as a chaste virgin unto Christ. We know that that same language is used of Christ's bride in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 23. So the ecclesia had once been a virgin, but because of that corrupting process that began way back in AD 32 and slowly brought forth this child through fornication, that process brought about the situation we see here in Revelation 12. She's now with child through fornication, as we saw in the words of the Lord Jesus Christ to Thyatira. The Jezebel class were at work, and they were seducing his servants to commit fornication, spiritual fornication, and that was to bring forth this man-child of sin. She seemed to be clothed with the sun. Now, this word clothed has the idea in the Greek of being invested by choice. It's not something that's forced upon you. She's invested by choice. This woman, this ecclesiastical system, the apostate church by the early 300s AD, had made the choice to align itself with the political powers of the day. So here we've got the apostate church in maturity. And in that maturity, it's invested by choice with the sun, which is the symbol, of course, also of government, because it rules the heavens. Around 300 AD, Christianity gained support from Constantine, a pagan worshipper of the sun god, who invested it with political authority. But the moon is also there in verse 1. The moon under her feet. The moon is the symbol, of course, of state ecclesiasticism, on the basis that the moon doesn't have any light of its own. It reflects the light of the sun. So what we see when we look up and see the moon in the sky is actually we're seeing the sun, because the sun on the other side of the earth, it's shining on the moon, and that's what we see. So it doesn't have any light of its own. It only reflects the light of the sun. And of course, that's a very important principle for you and me, isn't it? Because if we're dealing with the Son of Righteousness, and the ecclesia ought to reflect his light. So this is about pagan state religion being overthrown by pseudo-Christianity through the work of Constantine. He, being a pagan sun god worshipper, became the sole emperor. He gave his authority and power to the church to deal with their internal enemies. That's the story that happens here in the prophecy of Revelation 12. Now a crown is involved here in verse 1. There's a crown of 12 stars on her head, the Stephanos, the coronal victory wreath. Because, of course, the support of the Christians for Constantine enabled him to overthrow his opposition. And he rewarded them with a state religion. He rewarded them for their support by supporting them. The 12 stars, of course, is a reference to the 12 emperors that had ruled the Roman Empire from the time of Augustus to the time when John received this prophecy in AD 96. There had been 12 emperors. So again, that aligns with the fact that here is the woman, this ecclesiastical system, which used to be a chaste virgin, is now part of the Roman system, part of the Roman government. Now, I think most of you are fully aware of all of that, but we have to sort of step through this and see the interesting history that occurs. Now, the principal character in Revelation chapter 12 is this man, Constantine, the man of sin, because this woman gives birth, as it were, to this man in the process of him acquiring power in the Roman Empire. Now, he was a very prominent individual. He was the son of Pepin. Pepin was the, and we'll talk about him a little bit later, Pepin was the French king who supported the Pope against his enemies in the mid-700s AD. When he died, his son Charlemagne, in fact two of his sons took over, but Charlemagne got rid of the other one. Charlemagne became the king of France, and then ultimately in 800 AD he was crowned as Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. But in 796, which is 4 years before he became the Emperor of the HRE, and by the way, I'm not going to spell out Holy Roman Empire every time, it's a tongue twister, so I'll say HRE, and you know I mean the Holy Roman Empire. Got that one? Okay. So 4 years before he became the emperor, in 796, he built this cathedral in Aachen, which is in Germany. Its other name is, and this must be French, and I can't speak French to save myself, Aix-la-Chapelle or something like that. Something like that. So here is this cathedral, a famous cathedral. You can go there today and you can actually crawl under his throne. Yeah, you can crawl under his throne. You know why? Well, because you see, that's how he put people in servitude. You came to him, he said, crawl under my throne, you know, because I'm going to dominate you. That was the character of this man. In this cathedral, you have this sun image here. See that? Now, this is very important, because I want to show you what that sun image is actually about. The sun image for the worship of Mary in Charlemagne's cathedral in Aachen is curiously based on Revelation 12, verse 1. Well, yes, because they've stolen this imagery, see? The woman is there, ecclesiastical system. She's clothed with the sun. You see the rays of the sun around here? The moon, yep, the moon is down here. Under the feet, see the moon there, the crescent moon? The crown is on her head, and there are 12 stars involved here, the 12 emperors. Now, the 12 stars, of course, has been taken up by the European Union. Their flag has got 12 stars on it. And, of course, the European Union is all about rebuilding what? The HRE. Yeah. It's all about rebuilding the Holy Roman Empire. So you can see, can't you? You can see the links that are there. Pretty obvious links. So here's the man, the man-child of sin. Now, his father was Constantius, who was a pagan Roman. However, Constantius was sympathetic with the Christians. And the reason he was sympathetic with the Christians is because he was married to a woman called Helena, or Helen. And Helena was a Christian from Nice. So, of course, he's married to this woman, and she was a very, very dedicated Christian. In fact, when you go to the land, you will find many of the so-called holy sites were actually built by Helen. She was the one who promoted the Christian religion. And so she was totally devoted to it. So Constantius was sympathetic to the Christians. And so hence, Constantine, even though he was a pagan, his mother had a very strong influence on him. And when it was convenient for him, he used the Christians as a means of gaining power. So what happened was that ultimately the workings, the mystery of iniquity, the workings of that commercialized Judaism that we spoke about last evening, ultimately it prevailed in the church, it became apostate, and under Constantine, all of that was cemented into place, and the church, in its apostate form, became the state religion. That happened in 312. It was finally confirmed 12 years later in 324, when all of the pagan opposition was removed with the defeat of Licinius. And we'll have a bit of a chat about that in a moment. So what we have then is this pagan Roman dragon now awaiting the birth of the woman's child. And that's the story of verse 3 onwards. Revelation 12, verse 3. And there appeared another wonder or sign in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon. And when you read of a red dragon, you're reading about a pagan system. You know, Revelation 12 has some complications. Anybody who's done some work on it will know it's got some complications, but if you really want to get to the bottom of this, you need to listen to Brother Steve Hornart's series on this section, the Apocalypse, because he's the guru on the Apocalypse. And he's really got this nailed down. So that would be my advice to you. You're not going to get that from me today. You're not going to get all of the ins and outs because we don't have time to do that. We just want to get the essence of Revelation 12 in this session. You want to get the detail, you can get it from, for example, Steve's work on this. But we read here about this great red dragon having seven heads and ten horns. Now, clearly, of course, the the seven heads got to do with the forms of Roman government, and we'll talk about that in a second. Ten horns, as you know, ultimately the Roman Empire was broken up by the barbarians, and we have these formation of the ten horns. And seven crowns upon his head. His tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman, so this is the corrupt ecclesia, which was ready to be delivered of the man-child, Constantine, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. So this is all about the wars and the conflicts that went on from a little prior to 312 AD through to 324 AD. So it's a period of about 12 years or so that this is talking about, when there was all of this fighting and confusion going on until finally Constantine becomes the sole ruler of the Roman Empire. And to put it in the words of the seal, there was peace in heaven about the space of half an hour. Now, Constantine died in 337 AD. He attained his sole rulership in 324 AD. There's 14 years, inclusively, between 324 and 337, okay? And that's the only time in that era where the Roman Empire had peace. There was silence in heaven, or peace in government, about the space of half an hour, we read in Revelation 8, okay? Now, about the space of half an hour, it's not half an hour, it's about the space, yeah. Well, an hour in the apocalyptic terms is 30 years. A half an hour would be 15. And about the space, well, it's 14. So you can actually prove that the hour of judgment that we're going to talk about later on in our studies is 30 years from history. And that's just one. There's another one that you can use as well. So here we've got this story about the pagan dragon with its seven heads waiting there to devour the woman's child, Constantine. All right, got the picture so far? Is that clear enough? Clear enough? Good. So what are these seven heads? Well, Rome had seven forms of government in its history. By the time that John received the apocalypse on the Isle of Patmos, five had already come and gone. He was in the period of the sixth form of Roman government. So they went through in their history the regal, the consular, the dictatorial, the decemviral, and the tribunicial. All right, they were all history. They were all gone in AD 96. John was in the imperial era. And that's why in Revelation 17 you read, one of these heads is. Well, it was the imperial. That was John's time in AD 96. But it too was to go eventually, and the seventh head was to come along when the Goths invaded the Roman Empire and they took over its government for about 60 years. So that was from AD 493 that the Goths ruled for about 60 years. What then happened, as we shall see in our next study, God willing, is that there was a revival of the wounded sixth head. The imperial was revived. And that's a very important part of the prophecy in connection with the Catholic system, as we're going to see. So got a picture? There's your seven forms of government, or seven heads, head being a... Usually the head governs the body, not always, but anyway, usually the head governs the body. So when you talk about seven heads, you're talking about government, right? That's what it means here. So let's just review, shall we, the history of... Constantine. Now I'm going to do this in this form, not because I like doing it this way, but because you can follow me, and when I'm finished, there's a record of it. Okay, so you can actually go back and look at it again. The rise of Constantine. In 284, Diocletian became emperor. He's a pretty tough character. In 286, he took Maximian, and you got some Maximians and some Maximins, though don't mix up these people, they're quite separate. He took Maximian to share control as Augustus, meaning top Caesar. Then in 292, Galerius and Constantius, who's the father of Constantine, were made Caesars. So what you had was you had a structure where there were four emperors ruling the empire. So you had two top dogs and two lower dogs, okay? Well, they were dogs, actually, these people. And they were ruling the Roman Empire. Subsequently, Diocletian petitioned the empire, reserving Thrace and the Asiatic provinces for himself and giving Maximian Italy and Africa. Galerius Illyria and the countries of the Danube, and Constantius had Gaul, Spain and Britain. The latter, that is Constantius, openly favoured the Christians, while Maximian and Galerius were openly hostile to them. Diocletian, who had once been indifferent about Christians, was induced by Galerius to commence bitter persecution of the Christians in 303 AD, and in actual fact Christ makes reference to that in the letters. The terrible persecution that would come. It lasted for about 10 years. Terrible, bitter persecution headed up by Diocletian. Diocletian and then Maximian abdicated in 305. Now, emperors don't normally abdicate, but that's the kind of guy Diocletian was. He said, okay, well, I've had enough. I'm going to retire. I've got enough money in the bank. And so he passed over the empire to other people, leaving Galerius and Constantius to assume the highest dignity. So they became the Augusti with two new lower Caesars, Maximin, not to be confused with Maximian. Maximin and Severus. Contention raged for some years over imperial power, and at one stage, six emperors ruled. So it was getting a bit messy, wasn't it? In the east, Galerius, Maximin, and Licinius, and in the west, Maximian, who had resumed power, his son Maxentius, and his son-in-law Constantine. So Constantine, who's in Britain, ends up marrying the daughter of Maximian. So there's a little bit of to-ing and fro-ing going on here, a little bit of power, you know, acquisition of power by marriage and that kind of thing. ultimately, in 311, Constantine ruled Britain, Gaul and Spain. Maxentius was over Italy and Africa. Licinius was in Illyricum, which we would call the Balkans today. You know, that's the area of Yugoslavia, that area. And Maximin in Asia Minor, that's in like Turkey today, Syria and Egypt. Now, some of you probably are not all that much into history, and I'm aware of that, so I've tried to sort of distill this down. If you read Eureka, there's dozens and dozens of pages of history. So I'm just giving you the distilled version. So what we have after all of that is this situation. In 311, which is just a year before Constantine defeats Maxentius, we have Constantine over here in the west. He rules Spain, Gaul and Britain. You have Maxentius here in North Africa, also, of course, got involved in Italy. You had Licinius over here, the Illyrian section, and you had Maximin over here in the east. Okay, so that's how the empire looked in 311. Meanwhile, of course, the apostate church was looking for a suitor. And they're not going to choose someone who hates them, are they? They're going to choose someone who's going to support them. And the only one really that gave them the support that they needed, apart from Licinius at this stage, but he was wobbly, was this man over here, Constantine, because of his mother, Helena. Well, he didn't like the Christians much, but anyway, his mother was a Christian, so he couldn't sort of show his distaste too much. He was a pagan. But what about the rise of the apostate Christianity under Constantine? Well, this is what happened. Constantine declared in favour of Christians and was attacked by Maxentius, whom he defeated at the Battle of Milvian Bridge near Rome in 312. That then left three divisions of the empire. In verse 4, you'll notice it says, his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven. So the empire now has three divisions. Constantine and Licinius became allies in favour of the Christian cause, while Maximin, who was an intolerant pagan, continued to persecute them. The latter attacked Licinius but was defeated. So Maximin is defeated by Licinius. Licinius then repudiated Christianity, so he swaps horses and swore to exterminate it and restore paganism throughout the empire. That then led to war with Constantine, who was supported by the Catholic section of the Christian Church. That's what it means when it says in verse 7 of Revelation 12, there was war in heaven. Michael, which is the symbolic name for Constantine, and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels. The dragon there is Licinius and his force. So you've now got these two opposing forces. You've got Licinius, who once was sympathetic to Christians, who's changed horses. He's now defending paganism. He wants to destroy Christianity. He controls all of the East. And you've got Constantine, who controls the West. And there's war in heaven to resolve this situation. And, of course, it was Constantine who won. So let's just step back a little bit to 312. Let's step back to the first major battle. It's the Battle of Milvian Bridge. Now, this is the battle where Constantine is alleged to have seen in a dream, in a vision, a cross, you know, and make this your standard. You've all seen this. I mean, they make movies about it. He's alleged to have seen this cross. Now, we don't know whether that happened with a dip. Who knows? I don't know. But one thing we do know is that he used the Christians to support him militarily against his enemies. And they were involved in this. They went to war with him. They took up the sword with him, which is where the practice of the modern churches has come from. You know, in the First and Second World Wars, last century, the Christian churches were in there big time, weren't they? And it was these poor little Christadelphians who were thrown into jail because they're conscientious objectors against war. But the bulk of the armies of the Allies were so-called Christians. So the practice that began back here has been carried on down to the present day. So this Battle of Milvian Bridge was crucial. Now, in 2005, I actually walked over the Milvian Bridge and I took a few photographs. This is not my photograph, actually. But I want you to notice something about this bridge. It's obviously been rebuilt down through the ages. You see this orange sort of stone here? Well, that's probably only several hundred years old. You see this white stone down here? The white stone? That's the original, one of the original parts of the bridge. So it goes way back in history to AD 312. Now, you get a bit of an idea looking at that way. You think, oh, you could drive cars across. No, it's a walking bridge. You can only walk across there. It's only about 8 or 9, 10 feet wide. So they don't drive cars over it. So it was the bridge across the Tiber. Now, as you can see, it's about 7 kilometres. That's, 4 miles or so north of the Forum. So you've got the Forum down here in Rome and a little bit, about 3 or 4 miles. I know it's about 3 or 4 miles because I walked it in 38 degrees, which is, over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. So it was pretty hot. And I walked from Rome, from the Forum up to the Milvian Bridge, and I was a fool. I should have caught a bus. Anyway. So after Milvian, this is what the empire looked like. The green is Constantine. He controlled that western portion of the empire. The orange here is Licinius, who was in Illyrium, or what we would call the old area of Yugoslavia, Serbia, etc. And Maximin, the pagan, was over here. Well, what happened then, of course, was that Maximin attacked Licinius, and Licinius, you know, gave him a blood nose and took over his territory. And this is the situation when that happened, because now you only had two divisions of the empire. You had Constantine over in the west and you had Licinius, who had now switched horses and supported paganism. And these two men now come into conflict. That's the story of Revelation 12, verse 7. War in heaven. Here it is. There's the two sections, and this is how it all unfolded. Licinius and his pagan forces were finally overthrown in 324 AD. So from the Battle of Milvian Bridge in 312, another 12 years it took before we get to the situation where there's one emperor in the empire, Constantine. And Constantine was proclaimed sole emperor. Ultimately, he shifted his capital to Asia Minor and built Constantinople, which became the seat of the dragon power that we read of in Revelation 16 and verse 13. Revelation 12, verses 13 to 17, shows that the dragon and the woman took on new identities. Now, this is where it becomes a little complicated, and this is where I would recommend to you get a hold of Steve's work on this. He's done a pretty good job on that. The dragon and the woman took on new identities. The pagan dragon had become Christian and soon turned to persecute the remnant of the woman's seed, which of course means those who are continuing to hold the truth. And the woman then becomes the anti-Catholic element within Christianity. And that is where your transition occurs. And I'm not going to go in any of those details because it'll take another hour to do that properly. Okay? Happy with that? But at the end of chapter 12, in verses 13 to 17, this is your story. So let's just read that section. Verse 13. And when the dragon saw that he was cast unto the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. And to the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and a half of time. How many years is that? A time, times, and a half a time. Now, the reason I raise this now is because a little later on today, we're going to be doing some work on this. We need to be confident about what that means. Now, this is not new, is it? This comes from Daniel 7. Did someone say it? Yeah, I know. You know. Someone can say it. 3.5 years or 1260, thank you, Paul, or 42 months, based on the fact that you're using the old Babylonian system of 360 days in a year, which the Jews for a time adopted, okay? In the days of Daniel, that was the way that they figured things, 360 days in a year, even though, of course, there's actually 365 and sometimes a leap year. So you work on the basis of 360 days in a year, and you come out 3.5 years is 1260 years. And we're going to see just how important that period is in the scheme of things. So this is where the remnant, those trying to hold the truth, have to escape from the face of the serpent. And verse 15 says, and the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood. So this is this illustration you can see on the screen behind me. You've got the dragon, the old serpent, so to speak, casting out of his mouth water as a flood, trying to envelop this woman and destroy her. She takes wings, so to speak, the wings of an eagle, the wings of the spirit, truth, you might say, and she escapes. And the earth helped the woman. So there was support from others, you know, the political witness, the other elements of the religious witness. The earth helped the woman, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth. And he was wroth with the woman, and he went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God. So that woman constitutes the ecclesiastical system that ended up opposing the state religion that Constantine had formed. But it didn't consist of all believers. You know, there were people in that religious system that didn't have the truth. But within them, just like it is today, within the so-called Christian community of today, there's a small group called Christadelphians who had the truth. They're the ones who keep the commandments of God and had the testimony of Jesus Christ. But there are out there other people who say they're Christian, but they're apostates. But they're in opposition, maybe, as was this case, with the state religion that had been formed, which basically was pure paganism with a Christian garb. Got the picture? Okay. I'm going to finish on this note. In AD 325, and we mentioned this last night, in AD 325, they convened at a place called Nicaea in Bithynia. It's up near the Black Sea. And Constantine was the one who was involved in this. He presided over this council. He'd moved his capital to Constantinople in 324, so it wasn't very far away. A matter of getting in a boat, going out, you know, through the Bosphorus and around to the northern shore of the Black Sea, and there is this place called Nicaea. And they held this council because there was a huge dispute going on in the apostate church between two groups. One who upheld that God was one, the other upheld that God was a Trinity, and that Jesus Christ was actually God. All right, well, who's going to win this battle? Well, when you've got a man like Constantine presiding over the proceedings who's a pagan, you're not likely to get truth out of that, are you? And they didn't get truth out of it. They got the Nicene Creed out of it. That's where it came from. And the Nicene Creed is the basis of all churches who believe in the Trinity. And I don't know about you in this country, but in Australia, we have a problem with this. Because when we go to hire, like you've done this, and this is not a religious camp, obviously, but when we go to hire a religious centre to hold camps, we're often knocked back. Because either they know that we're non-Trinitarian, or they ask us, do you believe in the Trinity? Does your church, they say, believe in the Trinity? And we say no. And they say, well, sorry, but you can't hire this facility. Did that happen to you over here? Yeah. So, you know, the Trinitarians, they are determined to uphold their position. Well, it all came from the Council of Nicaea. It was attended by over 250 bishops. It had furious debates that went on between the Arians and others on the Godhead, and resulted in the issue of the Nicene Creed, which is all about that doctrine. Well, I mentioned last night that this year, in May 2014, the head of the Roman Catholic Church, Francis I, here he is, and the head of the Greek Orthodox Church, based in Constantinople, here he is, the Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew is his name. They were together in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. You know who built that? Helena. They were together in the church built by Helena, the mother of Constantine, and agreed that they would mark the 1,700th anniversary of the Nicene Council that was held in AD 325, and they're going to mark that in the year 2025. You got no idea how much I'm hoping Christ comes before 2015, because there's a 10-year period from the time he comes to Armageddon. I'm really hoping they never get to do it. Well, they may, who knows? But the time is ripe, isn't it, for that system to be put out of business. You know what this means, brethren? It means that the centuries-old long division between East and West is about to come to an end, and they're going to end it on the basis of going back to their roots, the doctrine of the Trinity. It's happening right now. Now, in our studies, we're going to follow through, because in our next study, God willing, we're going to have a look at this beast here and this one here, the beast of the sea and the beast of the earth. And they flow out of the Roman dragon. The pagan Roman dragon becomes Christianized under Constantine in 312. We're going to see how this imperial head is revived in the beast of the sea, and how it becomes the Holy Roman Empire in the beast of the earth. And that'll be our next study, God willing.